Go home. Cut your losses. Stay. Go for it. You are a republic of voices tonight. Unfortunately, the republic is Italy. All these voices are waving their arms and screaming at one another.
This week on Selected Shorts, bright lights, big city, and a father-daughter story.
It was still light, and the swallows dived in the canyon. Her father two-stepped over with a big plastic spoon and a chip full of salsa, singing in falsetto. No, you ain't seen nothing like the mighty Quinn. He gave her the chip and kissed her on the forehead.
I'm Parker Posey, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction, read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. Location, location, location. It's the siren song of realtors, but also a key part of short stories. On this program, we have two stories with characters who are about to lose themselves. The first is by Jay McInerney. It's 6 a.m., Do You Know Where You Are? It was first published in the Paris Review and turned into the first chapter of his celebrated novel, Bright Lights, Big City. But McInerney didn't know that at the time, as he told the audience at Symphony Space, where the story was read.
It's 6 a.m., Do You Know Where You Are? Was born in the somewhat bleak environs of Syracuse, New York, whence I'd fled Manhattan after being fired from The New Yorker. I'd been a fact-checker at The New Yorker for slightly less than a year when they discovered that I wasn't terribly interested in facts. I believed, like the talking heads, that facts all came with points of view, and they seldom did what I wanted them to do. I wanted to be a fiction writer, so I fled after being fired to Syracuse, New York, to study creative writing with Raymond Carver, an idol of mine and probably at that time the most influential short story writer in America. Like everyone else, I imitated Carver, writing stories with titles like, What the Hell Do You Say to That, Huh? I imitated other writers as well in search of my own voice. One day I sent out a story called In the Northwest Frontier Province to the Paris Review. This particular story, as I recall, was kind of a mashup of Robert Stone and Paul Theroux. And a few weeks later, I was astonished to receive a phone call from George Plimpton, the editor of the Paris Review, who told me in that silvery patrician voice of his that he liked the story and he was considering it for publication, but he wondered if I had anything else to show him before he made up his mind. So I immediately read through all of my old stories, and I realized that they were all pretty much derivative crap. But I found a paragraph written in the second person in my desk that I'd scrawled on a scrap of paper at dawn when I was kind of whacked out of my mind after a disastrous night on the town. And this struck me as something original, something in what just might possibly be my own voice. It went, you are not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are. I subsequently stayed up all night writing, it's 6 a.m., Do You Know Where You Are? And I sent it off to George Plimpton the next day, and it became my first published story when George brought it out in 1982. At some point, I realized that I had more to tell about this particular character and this particular voice, and the story became the basis for my novel, Bright Lights, Big City. When I first looked at that scrap of paper with its second-person late-night voice, it seemed to me to be sui generis, not quite like anything I'd read before. But of course, it had its antecedents. There is a large body of literature about the night, about intoxication, about drinking and bars, although I like to think I was among the first to set a work of fiction in an after-hours club. Damon Runyon is probably one of the greatest chroniclers of New York nightlife, the bard of the speakeasies and gambling houses of Prohibition. I was and remain a big fan of The Ginger Man by J.P. Dunleavy, much of which takes place in Irish pubs, much of which is narrated by a frequently intoxicated Sebastian Dangerfield. I'm also a fan of A Fan's Notes, the brilliant autobiographical novel or novelistic memoir, if you wish, by Frederick Exley, who spent much of his life in the bars of Watertown, New York. And I feel certain that the voice of "It's 6 a.m." is informed by Hunter Thompson and by Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in particular, with its inspired scenes of substance abuse in various Las Vegas hotel bars. I can't speak for my predecessors, but I found that after that initial paragraph, which I wrote down in a state of advanced intoxication, more or less transcribing my own interior monologue, the subsequent passages were the product of sobriety. I certainly never thought that I'd find myself listening to someone else read those lines for an audience some 30 years later.
Jay McInerney, on the origins of his story, "It's 6 a.m., Do You Know Where You Are?" is performed now by Jeremy Shamos, who appears regularly on and off Broadway and on such television series as Law & Order Criminal Intent and Damages, and was nominated for a Tony Award for his performance in Clybourne Park.
You are not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning. But here you are, and you cannot say that the terrain is entirely unfamiliar, although the details are a little fuzzy. You are at a nightclub, talking to a girl with a shaved head. The club is either the Bimbo Box or the Lizard Lounge. It might all come a little clearer if you could slip into the bathroom and do a little more Bolivian marching powder. Then again, it might not. There is a small voice inside you insisting that this epidemic lack of clarity is the result of too much of that already, but you are not yet willing to listen to that voice. The night has already turned on that imperceptible pivot where 2 a.m. changes to 6 a.m. You know that moment has come and gone, though you are not yet willing to concede that you have crossed the line beyond which all is gratuitous damage and the palsy of unraveled nerve endings. Somewhere back there, it was possible to cut your losses. But you rode past that moment on a comet trail of white powder and now are trying to hang on to the rush. Your brain at present is composed of brigades of tiny Bolivian soldiers. They are tired and muddy from their long march through the night. There are holes in their boots, and they are hungry. They need to be fed. They need the Bolivian marching powder. Something vaguely tribal about this scene. Pendulous jewelry, face paint, ceremonial headgear and hairstyles. You feel that there is also a certain Latin theme, which is more than the fading buzz of the marimbas in your brain. You are leaning back against a post, which may or may not be structural with regard to the building, but nonetheless feels essential for the maintenance of an upright position. The bald girl is saying this used to be a good place to come before the assholes discovered it. You do not want to be talking to this bald girl, or even listening to her, which is all you're doing, but you don't have your barge pole handy. And just at the moment, you don't want to test the powers of speech or locomotion. How did you get here? It was your friend Tad Allagash who powered you in here, and now he has disappeared. Tad is the kind of guy who certainly would be at a place like this at this time of the morning. He is either your best self or your worst self. You're not sure which. Earlier in the evening, it seemed clear he was your best self. You started on the Upper East Side with champagne and unlimited prospects, strictly observing the Allagash rule of perpetual motion, one drink per stop. Tad's mission in life is to have more fun than anyone else in New York City, and this involves a lot of moving around, since there is always the likelihood that you are missing something, that where you aren't is more fun than where you are. You are awed by this strict refusal to acknowledge any goal higher than the pursuit of pleasure. You want to be like that. You also think he is shallow and dangerous. His friends are all rich and spoiled, like the cousin from Memphis you met earlier in the evening who refused to accompany you below 14th Street because he said he didn't have a low-life visa. This cousin had a girlfriend with cheekbones to break your heart, and you knew she was the real thing when she never once acknowledged your presence. She possessed secrets about islands, about horses that you would never know. You have traveled from the meticulous to the slime. The girl with a shaved head has a scar tattooed on her scalp that looks like a long sutured gash. You tell her it is very realistic. She takes this as a compliment and thanks you. You meant as opposed to romantic. I could use one of those right over my heart, you say. You want, I can give you the name of the guy did it. You'd be surprised how cheap. You don't tell her that nothing would surprise you now. Her voice, for instance, which is like the New Jersey state anthem played through an electric shaver. The bald girl is emblematic of the problem. What the problem is that for some reason you think you are going to meet the kind of girl who is not the kind of girl who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning. When you meet her, you are going to tell her that what you really want is a house in the country with a garden. New York, the club scene, bald women, you're tired of all that. Your presence here is only a matter of conducting an experiment in limits, reminding yourself of what you aren't. You see yourself as the kind of guy who wakes up early on Sunday morning and steps out to pick up the Times and croissants. You take a cue from the arts and leisure section and decide to check out some exhibition, costumes of the Habsburg court at the Met, say, or Japanese lacquerware of the Muromachi period at the Asia Society. Maybe you'll call that woman you met at the publishing party Friday night, the party you did not get sloppy drunk at, an editor at a famous publishing house, even though she looks like a fashion model. See if she wants to check out the exhibition and maybe do an early dinner. You will wait until 11 a.m. to call her because, unlike you, she may not be an early riser. She may have been out a little late at a nightclub, say. It occurs to you that there is time for a couple sets of tennis before the museum. You wonder if she plays, but then, of course, she would. When you meet the girl who wouldn't, etc., you will tell her that you are slumming, visiting your own 6 a.m. Lower East Side of the soul on a lark, stepping nimbly between the piles of garbage to the marimba rhythms in your head. On the other hand, any beautiful girl, specifically one with a full head of hair, would help you stave off this creeping sense of mortality. You remember the Bolivian marching powder and realize you're not down yet. First, you have to get rid of this bald girl because of the bad things she's doing to your mood. In the bathroom, there are no doors on the stalls, which makes it tough to be discreet, but clearly you're not the only person here to take on fuel. Lots of sniffing going on. The windows in here are blacked over, and for this, you are profoundly grateful. Up, two, three, four. The Bolivian soldiers are back on their feet, off and running in formation. Some of them are dancing, and you must do the same. Just outside this door, you spot her. Tall, dark, and alone, half hiding behind a pillar at the edge of the dance floor. You approach laterally, moving your stuff like a bad spade through the slalom of a synthesized conga rhythm. She jumps when you touch her shoulder. Dance! She looks at you as if you had just suggested instrumental rape. I do not speak English, she says, after you ask again. Francais? She shakes her head. Why is she looking at you that way, like there are tarantulas nesting in your eye sockets? Are you by any chance from Bolivia or Peru? She is looking around for help now, remembering a recent encounter with a young heiress's bodyguard at Danceteria, or was it New Berlin? You back off, hands raised over your head. The Bolivian soldiers are still on their feet, but they've stopped singing their marching song.
you realize that we are at a crucial juncture with regard to morale. What we need is a good pep talk from Tad Allagash, who is nowhere to be found. You try to imagine what he would say. Back on the horse. Now we're really going to have some fun. Something like that. You suddenly realize that he has already slipped out with some rich hose queen. He's back at her place on Fifth Ave, and they're doing some of her off-the-boat quality drugs. They're scooping it out of tall Ming vases and snorting it off each other's naked bodies. You hate Tad Allagash. Go home. Cut your losses. Stay. Go for it. You are a republic of voices tonight. Unfortunately, the republic is Italy. All these voices are waving their arms and screaming at one another. There's an ex-cathedra riff coming down from the Vatican. Repent! There's still time. Your body is the temple of the Lord, and you have defiled it. It is, after all, Sunday morning. And as long as you have any brain cells left, a resonant patriarchal bass will echo down the marble vaults of your church-going childhood to remind you that this is the Lord's day. What you need is another overpriced drink to drown it out. But a search of pockets yields only a dollar bill and change. You paid 10 to get in here. Panic gains on you. You spot a girl at the edge of the dance floor who looks like your last chance for earthly salvation against the creeping judgment of the Sabbath. You know for a fact that if you go into the morning alone, without even your sunglasses, which you have forgotten, because who, after all, plans on these travesties, that the harsh, angling light will turn you to flesh and bone. Mortality will pierce you through the retina. But there she is, in her pegged pants, a kind of doo-wop retro ponytail pulled off to the side. Great lungs. As eligible a candidate as you could hope to find this late in the game, the sexual equivalent of fast food. She shrugs and nods when you ask her to dance. You like the way she moves, half tempo, the oiled ellipses of her hips and shoulders. You get a little hip and ass contact. After the second song, she says she's tired. She's on the edge of bolting when you ask her if she needs a little pick-me-up. You got some blow? She says. Monster, you say. She takes your arm and leads you into the ladies. There's another guy in the stall beside yours, so it's okay. After a couple of spoons, she seems to like you just fine, and you're feeling pretty likable yourself. A couple more, this girl is all nose. When she leans forward for the spoon, the front of her shirt falls open, and you can't help wondering if this is her way of thanking you. Oh, yes. I love drugs, she says as you march toward the bar. It's something we have in common, you say. Have you ever noticed how all the good words start with D, D and L? You try to think about this. You're not sure what she's driving at. The Bolivians are singing their marching song, but you can't quite make out the words. You know, drugs, delight, decadence, debauchery, you say, catching the tune now. Dexedrin, delectable, deranged, debilitated. An L, lush and luscious, languorous, lazy, libidinous. What's that, she says. Horny. Oh, she says, and casts a long, arching look over your shoulder. Her eyes glaze in a way that reminds you precisely of the closing of a sandblasted glass shower door. You can see that the game is over, though you're not sure which rule you broke. Possibly she finds H-words offensive and is now scanning the dance floor for a man with a compatible vocabulary. You have more, down and depressed, lost and lonely. It's not that you're really going to miss this girl who thinks that decadence and dexedrine are the high points of the language of the King James and Lear, but the touch of the flesh, the sound of another human voice. You know that there is a special purgatory waiting for you out there, a desperate half-sleep, which is like a grease fire in the brain pan. The girl half waves as she disappears into the crowd. There's no sign of the other girl, the girl who would not be here. There's no sign of Tad Allagash. The Bolivians are mutinous. You can't stop the voices. Here you are again. All messed up. And no place to go. It is worse than even you expected, stepping out into the morning. The light is like a mother's reproach. The sidewalk sparkles cruelly. Visibility unlimited. The downtown warehouses look serene and rested in this beveled light. A taxi passes uptown and you start to wave, then realize you have no money. The car stops, you jog over and lean in the window. I guess I'll walk after all, asshole. The cabbie leaves rubber. You start north, holding your hand over your eyes. A bum is sleeping on the sidewalk, swathed in garbage bags, and he lifts his head as you pass. God bless you and forgive your sins, he says. You wait for the cadge, but that's all he says. You wish he hadn't said anything. As you turn away, what is left of your olfactory equipment sends a message to your brain. The smell of fresh bread. Somewhere they are baking bread. You see bakery trucks loading in front of a loft building on the next block. You watch as bags of rolls are carried out onto the loading dock by a man with a tattooed forearm. This man is already at work so that regular people will have fresh bread for their morning tables, the righteous people who sleep at night and eat eggs for breakfast. It is Sunday morning and you've not eaten since... when? Friday night. As you approach, the smell of bread washes over you like a gentle rain. You inhale deeply, filling your lungs with it. Tears come to your eyes, and you are filled with such a rush of tenderness and pity that you stop beside a lamppost and hang on for support. You remember another Sunday morning in your old apartment on Cornelia Street when you woke to the smell of bread from the bakery downstairs. There was the smell of bread every morning, but this is the one you remember. You turn to see your wife sleeping beside you. Her mouth was open and her hair fell down across the pillow to your shoulder. The tan skin of her shoulder was the color of bread fresh from the oven. Slowly and with a growing sense of exhilaration, you remembered who you were. You were the boy and she was the girl. Your college sweetheart. You weren't famous yet, but you had the rent covered, and you had your favorite restaurant where the waitresses knew your name and you could bring your own bottle of wine. It all seemed to be just as you had pictured it when you discussed plans for marriage in New York. The apartment with the pressed tin ceiling, the claw-footed tub, the windows that didn't quite fit the frame. It seemed almost as if you had wished for that very place. You leaned against your wife's shoulder. Later, you would get up quietly, taking care not to wake her, and go downstairs for croissants and the Sunday Times. But for a long time, you lay there, breathing in the mingled scents of bread, hair, and skin. You were in no hurry to get up. You knew it was a moment you wanted to savor. You didn't know how soon it would be over, that within a year she would go back to Michigan to file for divorce. You approach the man on the loading dock. He stops working and watches you. You feel that there is something wrong with the way your legs are moving. Bread! This is what you say to him. You meant to say something more, but this is as much as you can get out. What was your first clue? He says. He's a man who served his country, you think, a man with a family somewhere outside the city, small children, pets. A garden. Could I have some? A roll or something? Get out of here. The man is about your size except for the belly, which you don't have. I'll trade you my jacket, you say. It is 100% raw silk from Paul Stewart. You take it off. Show him the label. You're crazy, the man says. Then he looks back at the warehouse. He picks up a bag of hard rolls and throws them at your feet. You hand him the jacket. He checks the label, sniffs the jacket, then tries it on. You tear the bag open and the smell of warm dough rushes over you. The first bite sticks in your throat and you almost gag. You will have to go slowly. You will have to learn everything all over again.
Jeremy Shamos read Jay McInerney's It's 6 a.m., Do You Know Where You Are? I'm Parker Posey. After our brief break, a father-daughter story from Miley Malloy. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm Parker Posey. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wmyc.org/shorts. And please write and tell us what you think of today's program. Writer Miley Malloy lives in Los Angeles now, but her fiction often draws on the contours of her home state in Montana. In Red from Green, a father and daughter take a stranger on a fishing trip, and their own bond is tested. Malloy is the author of the novels Liars and Saints and A Family Daughter, and the story collections Half in Love and Both Ways is the Only Way I Want It. She's also an award-winning young adult writer, with her debut book, The Apothecary, and its sequel, The Apprentices. Read from Green, read by Patricia Callender.
The summer she turned 15, Sam Turner took her last float trip down the river with her father. It was July and hot, and the water was low. Hardly anyone was on the river but them. They had two inflatable Avon rafts with oaring frames, Sam and her father in one, her uncle Harry, and a client from Harry's new law firm in the other. In the fall, she would be a sophomore, which sounded very old to her. She'd been offered a scholarship to a boarding school back east, but she hadn't officially accepted it yet. Applying had been her father's idea, but now he looked dismayed every time the subject came up. Everyone said what an opportunity it was, so much better than the local schools, but neither of them could bring themselves to talk about it. Sam had been down the river every summer for as long as she could remember, in a dozen rainstorms and in hot sun that burned the print of swimsuit straps into her shoulders. Harry, her father's younger brother, sometimes brought his friends, who passed the bottle of schnapps to her when her father was away from the campfire. She liked the smell better than the burning taste. She knew all the campsites and the cliff-shaded turns of the river, and the long, flat stretch through pasture at the end. It was a 4-day float trip, or five if you dawdled, or three if her father had to get back to work. Her uncle's client was the reason they were on the river so late, when it was all sandbars and rocks. Sam hadn't been told that exactly, but it was the feeling she got, that they were going for this client. He had come from somewhere else and was staying in Montana only for the case. She met him at the put-in, unloading the gear. Harry introduced her as his niece. "You got a name?" the client asked. "Sam," she said. "Layton," the client said. He was younger than her uncle, and he wasn't tall, but he was big in the chest and arms. He set a full cooler on the ground and put out a hand to shake hers. "God, I like being up here," he said. "I'm part Crow, part Blackfoot, part Sioux, I think, part Jewish." His eyes were blue. He let her hand go. "You have perfect teeth," he said. "Did you have braces?" "No," she said. She was awkward at 15, and praise made her suspicious. Layton said, "This is going to be fun." Her father and Harry drove both empty trucks downriver to the place they'd take out 3 days later, to leave one and bring the other back. Sam stayed with the boats, and Layton volunteered to stay with her, to keep her safe, he said. They sat on the bank with the gear, sliding the coolers along the grass as the sun moved to keep them in the shade. Sam was reading The Thornbirds, bought at the supermarket along with the ice and groceries on the way out of town. "It's not on your reading list," her father had said, dropping it in her lap in the truck, "but it's the best thing they had." The boarding school had sent her a summer reading list with 30 books on it, books like The Portrait of a Lady and Tender as the Night, but in her reluctance, she'd forgotten to bring one along. Layton took out a shotgun to clean and oil it. "I bet you're a crack shot," he said. "Montana girl like you, I bet you've got your own guns." Sam shook her head and kept reading. He brought the gun over to show her the sight, which was just a notch of steel on the barrel. He crouched close to her shoulder, and she could smell the oil on the gun. "You don't need a fancy sight for a shotgun," he said. "You ever fire one?" "No," she said. Her father had guns, but he hadn't been hunting since her mother died. Sam barely remembered her mother. She'd hit black ice driving to Coeur d'Alene when Sam was 4. She sometimes wondered if her father had quit hunting because he'd been busy taking care of her, or if he'd just stopped liking to shoot things. "Oh, boy," Layton said. He stood up. "We got to take care of that. Get you a pheasant." "It isn't bird season." "No one will know out here," he said. He ran a cloth over the barrel. "There are houses on the river," she told him. "It's not very remote." Layton laughed. "Remote. That's a good word." She felt her cheeks heat up, but didn't say anything. "I don't need very remote," he said. "Just a little remote." She knew that her father wouldn't tolerate poaching, so she left it for him to take care of. But when he and Harry drove up, her father just looked hard at the shotgun and started loading his boat. They put in that afternoon, and in spite of the low water, they got to the first campsite before dark. Her father had a 2-man tent for himself and a burrow for her, a waterproof sack just big enough for a sleeping bag with a mosquito net at the top. She set up the burrow with her sleeping bag inside, and Layton and Harry built a fire and talked about the case. Harry was childless and had been jobless on and off. He had always seemed to take pride in being the wild younger brother. Sam's father was a district judge. But something had come over him a few years ago, and he had gone to law school and managed to pass the bar. He was a big man with a belly, and everyone liked him. He was trying to get out of debt, and the lawyer he had joined up with had given him Layton's case. There were 4 other plaintiffs, all lab workers with neurological damage from exposure to organic solvents. One of them couldn't remember her children's names if someone nearby was wearing perfume. Diesel fumes, bathroom cleaners, scented soaps, new carpet, anything could set it off. Another had stopped driving because she didn't always know whether a red light meant stop or go. Layton was a key plaintiff because he had nothing in common with the women except the lab, where he had worked for a month on the wiring, and his tests matched all of theirs. It was good, too, to have a man involved. People were less likely to assume that he was inventing his symptoms. But his symptoms were milder, and he'd had to be cajoled into joining the lawsuit and then into sticking around to go to depositions and have more tests. Sam guessed the river trip was part of the cajoling. "I don't know," Layton said, standing over the fire ring. "I lose my car keys sometimes, but I did that before. I'm not very litigious. I might just take that job in Reno and scrap this whole thing." Harry frowned at his tower of twigs. "When you could be here," he said, "fishing and hunting." "It's not even bird season yet," Layton said, and he winked at Sam. "If this thing drags out much longer, I'll go nuts." Harry said nothing, but worked on the fire. The next morning, Layton was in the water before breakfast, fishing in waders, which no one ever brought in a boat on the river. They just waded out in shorts. He caught a little brown trout, clubbed its head, and threw it in the raft. Sam's father held the fish to the marks on the raft's rubber bow and said it wasn't big enough. "Pull on the tail a little," Layton said. "It'll stretch." He was already moving back into the current, and the fish was dying. Sam saw Harry give her father a look, and her father put the fish in the cooler. They packed up early and got on the river. Sam rode in the front of her father's raft, lying across the cooler that slid into the metal frame. She read for a while and then fell asleep with the sun on her back, waking to jump in the water and drag the raft over sandbars. At camp that afternoon, her father went fishing, and she walked away from the river up toward the hills. The grass in the open was pale yellow, and the path through the trees spiked with sunshine. But she was thinking about boarding school. She had a sense that she wasn't equipped for it. And she was wondering if she really had perfect teeth, and if anyone but adults would ever care. When Layton came through the trees, she knew she wanted him to show up, though she hadn't known it before. His attention was different from other adult attention. "I brought you something," he said. She waited, but he kept on up the trail, and she followed him. They got over the first hill from camp and up a second, higher one, and down again into a clearing. There weren't any farms or houses, and they were a long way from the river. Layton reached under his shirt and pulled out a small pistol, dark gray, with a short, square barrel. There was a fallen tree 10 yards away with small branches sticking up, and he stood an empty beer bottle upside down on one of the branches. The last of the beer stained the bark of the tree. Then he walked back and gave her the pistol. It was still warm from his skin and heavy. 9mm Ruger semi-automatic, he said. My pride and joy. Can they hear it? I don't think so, with those hills, he said. Anyway, we're legal. We're not killing anything. He took her right hand and shaped it around the gun. One hand like this, arm straight, just like the movies, he said. He reached around her shoulders and positioned her left hand, the other underneath. He kicked the instep of her right foot. Bring this leg back. Sam stepped back and pointed the gun at the bottle, not really breathing, with his chest against her back. Close one eye, he said. Cover your target with the barrel. The gun's going to kick up, but it'll drop right back where you need it. You only need to squeeze a little. He let her go and stepped away. She missed the bottle completely on the first shot, and the kick surprised her. The gun's explosion shot through her hands and shoulders and down into her legs. The second time, she blew away the upended bottom. The third time, she hit the broken-off neck. Then there was just a little triangle of glass sticking up from the tree. "Go for it," Leighton said. She did, and hit it, and there was nothing left but a stub of branch. "Hit the branch," Leighton said, and she did. She'd never been so proud of anything. Leighton reached out and rubbed the top of her head, quick. "She's a sharpshooter," he said. "You're not afraid of the kick yet, so you're not anticipating anything. You've got to keep that." "Okay," she said. She could feel herself grinning like an idiot. "Those perfect teeth," Leighton said. She closed her mouth and looked at the scarred tree where the bottle had been, which made her want to smile again, but she didn't. "I'm sorry," Leighton said. "That's okay," she said. When they walked back to camp, Leighton veered off, so they came from different angles. Her father and Harry didn't say anything. Sam thought they must have heard the shots, but she figured it could have been Leighton shooting alone. She had hit quarters propped in the tree bark and made a smiley face in a piece of paper. In the pocket of her shorts, she carried an exploded hollow point, which Leighton said wasn't legal to buy anymore, and a warped quarter. Leighton slipped the folded smiley face into the camp garbage bag and told Harry he didn't think there were pheasants out here at all. Sam's father was making enchiladas and chipping ice for margaritas with a pick. He made one without tequila for Sam. Leighton asked for a virgin, too. Alcohol made him nauseated since the work in the lab, and got out a little stereo with batteries. Sam's father said it would ruin the silence of nature, but pretty soon he was dancing at the cook stove, singing along with reggae covers. It was still light, and the swallows dived in the canyon. Her father two-stepped over with a big plastic spoon and a chip full of salsa, singing in falsetto. "No, you ain't seen nothing like the mighty Quinn." He gave her the chip and kissed her on the forehead. Her Uncle Harry had too many margaritas and started talking about the case, about those poor, sick women with their lives ruined, and the gall of the lawyers who said they were making it up. When it got dark, he went to bed. The other three sat close around the orange coals of the fire, and her father made up blues songs on the harmonica. After a while, Leighton said, "I need someone to walk on my back if I'm going to row tomorrow." "I'd ask you," he said to Sam's father, "but I'm guessing you weigh about 250. Her father didn't say anything. He kept playing harmonica. Leighton looked at Sam, who looked at the fire. "It just takes a minute," he said. "I threw it out on a job, and rowing that boat just messed it up." Her father kept his eyes closed, the harmonica wailing. Sam stood up. "Shoes off," Leighton said. She slipped off her sandals and left them by the fire. Leighton lay on his stomach on the ground. "Okay, step on careful," he said, "right in the middle." She stepped, squeezing the air out of his voice. "Now the other foot," he said. "Keep your balance." She could feel his ribs beneath her toes. "Now walk forward slowly, then back," he said. She did, and her father got up from the fire. "I'm beat," he said. "We should get an early start tomorrow." Sam looked at him, and he nodded as if agreeing with himself. He put away his harmonica and disappeared into the dark where his tent was pitched. She could hear the rustle of nylon and the whine of the zipper, and then the night was quiet. "Oh, one more time," Leighton said. "Oh, that's so great. Now, if you kneel with your knees between my shoulder blades, that's all I need." She knelt like he said, lowering her hips to her heels, looking down at her bare knees and the short hair at the back of his head. "Now hold it there," he whispered. "Oh, God." Then he didn't say anything. The right side of her body was warm from the fire. The left side was cold. It was too cold at night to be wearing shorts. She heard her father roll over in his sleeping bag inside the tent, nylon against nylon. Leighton's hand came back and touched her hip. "You're tilted to the side," he said. She straightened. "There," he said. But his hand stayed on her hip. She thought about what to do. His eyes were closed, and he seemed to have forgotten the hand. After a minute, it slipped under the back of her thigh, touching her skin. She took his wrist and moved it away. The hand paused in the air, then slipped back under her thigh, over her shorts, touching between her legs with a shock like the jolt of the gun firing in her hands. She started to stand up awkwardly, but he found her calf and pulled her back down. "Stay," he whispered. She was on one knee, half straddling his back in the dust, and he rolled over, facing her. His hand slid up her leg to the small of her back and held tight. His eyes were cloudy and intent, focused and unfocused, and she'd never seen a man look that way before. She pulled away then, and he let her go, and she left the fire and climbed, trembling, into a burrow. She lay awake long after the moon rose, listening to the sounds in the camp, to her father snoring, and Leighton finally putting out the fire, and the unzipping of his tent, and the rustle of his going to bed. She kept her hands between her thighs for warmth, and the feeling there was sharp and aching, but she didn't know what to do about it except lie awake, breathing, until it went away. When she woke up, Leighton was out in the river again, walking downstream and casting at the banks. It was the brightest day yet, and a mayfly hatch hovered over the water. The current dimpled with the open mouths of rising trout. Her father poured the last of the hot water into the oatmeal in her cup, and she ate standing. In her shadow on the ground, she could see her hair, 3 days uncombed, sticking out on one side. She smoothed it down with her hand. On the long flat stretch to the takeout, Sam rowed for a while. Her father pointed out a kingfisher in the brush along the banks, an osprey nest perched on the top of a tall tree. When she got the boat stuck on a rock, her father didn't say anything, but took the oars backward and pried it off. Leighton and Harry stayed well ahead. It got hot, and she slipped off the raft and dropped under, feeling the cold current in her hair and clothes. Leighton didn't look at her at the takeout. They deflated the rafts and packed up the truck with the drained energy feeling of a trip being over, and she changed into dry shorts in the trees. Her father drove, and Harry had the other window, so she was squished with Leighton in the middle, his left leg pressed against her right. They dropped her uncle and Leighton at the put-in with Harry's truck and drove home in silence. Sam tried to keep her eyes open but fell asleep. At the house, they unpacked the truck and hosed out the coolers, and when she gathered up her book and her river shorts, the hollow point fell out of the pocket onto the grass. Her father picked up the bullet, rolled it in his hand, held it between his fingers. It was copper-cased, splayed out in a blossom of dull lead where the tip had been. "Where'd you find this?" he asked. "I shot it." She waited for the next question. He said nothing, but held out the slug to her, and she took it. He picked up one of the dry boxes and carried it into the shed. For a while, she listened to him unpacking, putting pots where they belonged, not noisily or angrily, just putting them away. Then she went into the house and filled out the final form for the scholarship to boarding school. And in the morning, she put it in the mail. She said nothing at first, and life went on as usual. She finished the Thornbirds and saw her friends and ate dinners with her father. They talked about the weather and the cases he'd heard. And then after a week, she told him that she'd accepted the scholarship. He frowned at the table. "Oh," he said. "Good. That's great." She wanted to ask, why he had left her by the campfire, but instead she said, "Orientation is the last week of August. I should get a ticket." "Sure," he said. "Right." He looked straight at her, and his eyebrows knit together. "I'll miss you here." She felt a flood of warmth for him, an overwhelming feeling that it was a mistake to go away. He hadn't meant to leave her there. He hadn't known what would happen. He definitely hadn't meant for it to happen. Again, she wanted to ask, to make sure. But instead, she took her dishes to the sink. And the moment was over. A few days before she went away, there was a legal brief on the kitchen counter with the names of her uncle's other plaintiffs, but without Layton's. When she asked about it, her father said Layton had left for a job in Reno and had taken himself off the case. He decided his symptoms weren't so bad and it wasn't worth it. He got little rashes under his eyes and he couldn't drink. So what? He needed to stop drinking anyway, he said. There wasn't anything keeping him in Montana, and it was too much of a hassle to stay involved from Reno. Her father drove her to the airport and carried her bag right up to the gate before saying, for the first time, that he didn't really want her to go. She cried all the way down the jetway, and the man in the seat beside her gave her a packet of Kleenex to stop her nose from running and patted her shoulder when they landed in Salt Lake. Someone from the airline told her where to change planes, and from Boston, she took the bus she'd been told to take. Though it seemed impossible that it could be the right one, she was red-eyed and nervous, but had decided that she didn't know anything, and the idea of going away was to learn. Her dorm was in a cluster of stately brick buildings, surrounded by trees, set apart from the little town, and the walls of her room had been painted over and over for generations. She read The Portrait of a Lady There, and also The Beach House and Candy. 15 was old at boarding school. Most of the kids' parents didn't want them at home, and knowing that, the kids seemed to know everything. A girl down the hall had done ecstasy with her boyfriend back in Maryland and had sex for 3 hours straight. Sam's roommate, Gabriella, whose last roommate got the Latin teacher fired, was surprised and impressed that Sam was a virgin. There was a phone in the hall, and when Sam's friends from home asked for her, Gabriella said, "They sound so Western." One of them, Kelly Timmons, had just sent Sam a letter about a boy they knew. "We didn't have sex," she wrote, "but imagine as sick as you can imagine without having sex." Gabriella had laughed, reading the letter, and asked, "What does she mean?" Sam called home every week or two, and her father reported on people who'd asked about her, and she told him what she was doing in school. When she told him she was going to New York with Gabriella for Thanksgiving, he sounded startled. He said, "I'd get you a ticket home," though they hadn't talked about it before. "I know," she said, "but it's 2 days of flying for 2 days there." That had been Gabriella's argument. "Where will you stay?" "With her mom." There was a silence on the line, and she imagined the quiet, empty house around him. "What happened to Harry's chemical case?" she asked. "It got dismissed," her father said. "They needed that guy." "What was his name?" "On the river." "Layton," she said. "Layton," he said. "You can't blame him. He wasn't really that sick." "And the other people?" "They can't work," her father said. "They have these awful headaches all the time, and they can't go out. I'm sorry." "It was a tough case," he said. He asked a few questions about school, and then they said goodbye, and Sam hung up, thinking about the woman who couldn't drive, because the chemicals and everything made her forget which light meant stop and which go. She lay back on her bed under Gabriella's Charlie Parker poster and stretched her leg up to her face so her nose touched her knee, which was something Gabriella did. She brought the leg down and stretched the other one up. She thought about the parties there were supposed to be in New York and the boy from Exeter Gabriella was thinking about sleeping with and the dime bag Gabriella was trying to get. She thought about her father eating dinner alone on the dark winter nights with no one to talk to, and her friends, Kelly Timmons and the others, laughing in the hallway of her old high school with its rows of lockers and the fluorescent lights reflected in the shiny floors. She thought about the pink cleaning stuff the janitors used, the smell of it in the mornings when she got to school, and the shampoo dispensers on the walls of the girls' gym showers that said, Montana Broom and Brush. She thought about her father nodding to her after saying goodnight by the campfire, and about the aching feeling later as she lay in her sleeping bag, and how she hadn't understood what it meant. She smelled Gabriella's honey soap in the back of her wrist, and then her roommate walked in. Where are you? Gabriella asked. You're doing that spacey thing again. Sam smiled. No, I'm here. You're not. You're off in Montana or something. Do you have any letters from Sick Kelly? No. Gabriella looked disappointed, but then she brightened. Oh, I have to tell you what just happened in the library, she said. You know that reading room you can lock? Sam nodded and rolled over to listen, tucking her pillow under her arms and her chin. The detergent on the pillowcase was Mountain Fresh. Gabriella flopped down on the new rug and tossed back her long, conditioned hair. The rug was cream-colored, and Gabriella ran her hand across it, smoothing the fibers down. She looked a little flushed. Okay, here's how it started, she said. And the story, full of longing and intrigue, began.
Patricia Kallenber reading Miley Malloy's Red from Green. I'm Parker Posey. Next week, Magical Fun from Edgar Carret, Gary Steingart, and Stephen Milhauser. Selected Shores is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Julie Hurd. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deardorff Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Parada. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.